Hello, and welcome to Wiki Politiki, a show designed to bring right and left front and center, to turn the funk into function, and leave the junk at the junction. At a time when so much political discourse is heat without light, Wiki Politiki shines the light of love and truth on the darkened corridors of power, and then brings leading solutionaries into conversation to light the way forward together. Your host is Steve Behrman, author, comedian, and political and spiritual uncommentator. You might know Steve as his cosmic comic alter ego, Swami Beyondananda, or as the author of a more serious book with cellular biologist Bruce Lipton, Spontaneous Evolution. If you recognize that crisis precipitates evolution, and judging by the current crises, the chances of precipitation are 100%, this show is for you. Welcome to the Evolutionary Upwising. Now, here is your host, Steve Behrman.
Well, welcome to Wiki Politiki, Conversations for Co-Creation, where we shed light on the undarkened corridors of power and shine a light on the path ahead to where evolution is taking us. Now, the purpose of our Wiki Politiki radio broadcast is to bring left and right front and center, to face the music and dance together, and to address problems together rather than defend positions. Now we have another purpose as well, and that is to provide context at a time when the content can be contradictory, confusing, and overwhelming. Our guest this week, Harvey Wasserman, is a great provider of clarifying context. For nearly half a century, he's been noted as a progressive historian, anti-nuclear activist, an outside-the-matrix political uncommentator. His breakthrough book, Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States, was first published by Harper & Row in 1972 with an introduction by Howard Zinn. Harvey's mission for many years has been the permanent shutdown of the nuclear industry, and I was curious to discover that he actually originated the slogan, No Nukes. And his other mission on the positive side moving toward is the birth of Solartopia, a democratic and socially just green-powered Earth free of all fossil and nuclear fuels. Welcome, Harvey.
Hey, it's great to be with you. I've followed you for many, many years. You're really terrific, and I'm honored to be on your show.
Well, thank you so much. And I read your book back in the day. I guess that dates both of us. But let's begin in the here and now. You published an article called 57 Unpatriotic Ways the Corporate Democrats Have Enthroned Trump Putin. And it seems to be an accurate, if disheartening, account of our current, and here's the new word, situation. So how would you – everybody knows what that word means for some reason. How would you describe where our country is at today, and how does it relate to the article you just published?
Well, we're in really deep trouble. We're in a deep coma, actually. I'm just finishing a new history of the United States based on cycles of history, six cycles basically describing all of U.S. history. And it, one of the things it does – which I want to make sure I mention is that it properly attributes the contributions of the indigenous Americans to the formation of our country. I mean, we actually had the world's most advanced democracy in North America in 1140 AD. It was formed by an Iroquois or Haudenosaunee holy man named Daganoweda. Who there were five tribes who were four nations who were fighting each other constantly, the Mohawk, the Oneida, the Onondaga, the Seneca, and the Cayuga. Today we call them the Iroquois. They called themselves the Haudenosaunee, the people of the Longhouse. And in 1140 A.D., when Europe was still just pulling itself out of the Dark Ages, Daganoweda and his spokesman, Hiawatha, went to the five nations, and formed a Congress. And they had a very, very advanced government in North America. They had 117 codicils, which was basically a Bill of Rights. Each one of the five nations sent a representative to the Confederacy. The chiefs were all men, but they were chosen by the women of the tribe. Like most indigenous societies, the Haudenosaunee were matriarchal. And so, unfortunately, we've come a long way from that. I do mention that because virtually no history of the United States until mine has properly credited the formative power of the Iroquois Confederacy. There was one American who really understood how advanced the Iroquois was, and that was Ben Franklin. And Franklin, of course, was the great godfather of the American Republic. He's the true father of our country in more ways than one. He was a great lover of women. And I try to, you know, here we have Trumputin, Donald Trump, running around calling Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas as if that was a put-down. Pocahontas was actually a very great woman, and it's a great compliment to be compared to Pocahontas. But of course, Trump would never understand that. So, unfortunately, what we have today is the end of the empire. I mean, you know, as Swami Beyondananda, you certainly understand the concept of karma. And what Trump really is, aside from being basically a mobster or a gangster, I mean, that's basically, he's a mafia guy. He grew up in a mafia family. His father was a New York developer, a supporter of the Ku Klux Klan, and he couldn't have run his business without the five families in New York. I mean, he was completely entwined with the underworld, as is Trump. And I call him Trump Putin because his mob boss is Putin. I mean, people don't quite understand that the relationship between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin is not particularly complicated. Donald Trump, who's a terrible businessman, went bankrupt, four or five times, couldn't really manage his businesses, but he did master the media. And beginning in the mid-80s, he started laundering money for the Russian mafia. And that's how he stayed afloat. And that's what his connection to Putin really is. Putin is his mob boss. I mean, some people want to compare Donald Trump to Don Corleone. He's not smart enough to be Don Corleone. Putin is Don Corleone. Trump is Fredo, if you remember the movies.
So at any rate,
where we are today is the end of empire. And Donald Trump is a cumulative figure embodying all the terrible karma of the horrible dictators that the American empire has put in power over the past 200 years. I mean, think of Pinochet in Chile, Mobutu in Congo, Somoza in Nicaragua, Marcos in the Philippines, all these horrible dictators that the U.S. put in power. That's Trump coming back to, pay us back. I mean, imagine being a citizen of Chile in 1973 on 9/11 when the Americans came in and murdered Salvador Allende, who was really a lot like Bernie Sanders, and putting in a guy, Pinochet, who's a lot like Trump. I mean, that's basically what we're facing now.
You know, the Swami has called Donald Trump America's balloon karma payment. So I think we're on the same page there.
that's exactly right. That's a very good, I like that a lot. I mean,
steal it and use it, because I think we need to see that he's really an expression of everything that we've done wrong. And we've taken the nicey face off of the empire. We now have the appropriate face on it. By the way, I really do appreciate that you're bringing the indigenous people back into American history. In Spontaneous Evolution, by the way, plug for my book, we talk about that. We talk about Benjamin Franklin actually hearing a speech by Canasatego, who was the Iroquois chief at that time, doing a demonstration where he had all of the he had an arrow, and he broke it in half very easily. When he when he tied together 12 arrows, at that point there were 12 colonies. Of course, not even the strongest one in the group could break those arrows.
Right.
And so that
Franklin,
was Go ahead.
Franklin was such a transcendent figure. I mean, in my book, which is coming up soon, is called The Life and Death Spiral of U.S. History, from Daganoweda, who was never mentioned in any of the history books. Daganoweda was the founder of American democracy. He is the one who pulled together the Iroquois Confederacy. So it's from Daganoweda to the Trumpocalypse. But, you know, the Life and Death Spiral, these six spirals got shorter, and they pretty much culminated, as far as I'm concerned, American democracy as originally conceived was definitively dead in 1992, when the Clintons came in. And the Clintons, you know, Donald Trump is terrible, but the Clintons, you know, and Bush and Obama, they were not great in any way, shape, or form. I mean, the Clintons were awful. Bush, of course, was a disaster, and Obama was terrible. My wife came up with the greatest description of Obama. She called him a hologram. You know, this is a guy who totally mastered the theatrics of the president. He was an absolute genius, Obama, in handling the visuals of being president of the United States. He's a brilliant guy, personable, stayed in shape, you know, handled the press conferences, handled the public beautifully, also completely scandal-free, both personally. There wasn't a single indictment that came out of the Obama administration. That's pretty much unheard of in American history. But he did terrible things, and there were no policy advances whatsoever except for Obamacare, which is, you know, a slight improvement, better than nothing. But other than Obamacare, this country has not had a single major social or environmental program since the early 1970s. You know, it was really Vietnam, the end of empire, that put us into a terminal collapse, and Trump is just the logical outcome, as you put it so perfectly. He's the balloon payment at the end of empire.
Now, it's interesting. I'm going to go back a little bit because we're going to pick up on this, of course. But you wrote that book when you were in your 20s, Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States. How did you end up, first of all, with your name on it, like Harvey Wasserman? How did you end up with your name on it, and how did you land a contract with a major publisher at that point when you were in your 20s?
Well, it's a great story. Just for the record, I no longer go by Harvey Wasserman. Harvey Weinstein, I never liked Harvey anyway, the name Harvey. I just moved to L.A., and in L.A., you don't want to be Harvey Wasserman. It's like,
no, you
it's
don't
like
want
Weinstein,
to be Harvey.
You know. No, so I am called Sluggo. I used to be a ball player, and Sluggo was my name on the hippie farm that I lived on for 14 years. So as you are beyond Ananda, you can call me Sluggo.
I will call you Sluggo from here on in. Yeah.
Thank you. So what happened was I always wanted to be a history teacher. I'm right from the start, weirdly enough, when I was an early teen, 13 years old, I was reading biographies of Jefferson and Franklin. I have no idea why, and I have no idea. I don't think I got anything out of them, but for some reason I was reading them. And I always wanted to be a teacher. And then so I got a Woodrow Wilson Fellowship in 1967-8 after the University of Michigan. I went to the University of Chicago. I spent the year there dodging the police, and I was at the Chicago Convention. I got beat up twice demonstrating against the war in Vietnam. But I've never gotten my Purple Heart. You know, I got to send into the Army to get my Purple Hearts. So at the University of Chicago, I encountered a wonderful radical professor who's still alive named Jesse Lemish and another one named Staunton Lind. And they
I knew Staunton Lind, by the way. I knew Staunton Lind, yes.
He's still alive. Staunton still lives in Niles, Ohio. He's a wonderful man.
Wow.
They prompted me to rethink all of my history, what I thought I knew about U.S. history. So being 23, 24 years old, in all humility, I decided to write my own history of the United States. And after Chicago, long story short, a wonderful story, I wound up on a hippie farm in western Massachusetts. And my uncle, who was a socialist and used to go stand on soapboxes in the Boston Common and give speeches for socialism, he had a bookstore in downtown Boston, which is still there. It's the Brattle Bookshop. It's run now by my cousin, Kenny Gloss is his name. And I used to go in, and George would give me armloads of books, and I went back to my hippie farm 90 miles west, and I'd sit in the garage there, and I wrote, wrote. I love to write. And I came out with a manuscript. I thought I was going to write a whole history of the U.S., but when I got to the period between 1860 and 1920, I kind of fell into a rabbit hole, and I felt totally familiar, as if I had been living in the era. So I wrote a 300-page manuscript of the robber barons, the populist farmers, the socialist workers, especially Eugene B. Debs, and then the hippies. There was a bohemian movement before World War One. People were actually smoking pot, taking peyote, you know, free love, great jazz was the rock and roll of the time. And it was just a magical thing. So I wrote this manuscript, and I was sending it to various publishers. And I was getting letters like, you know, never send us anything again, stuff like that. But I had one editor at Harper & Row who was kind of interested. And then I sent it to Howard Zinn, the wonderful, famous historian at Boston University. And we had some mutual friends. And, you know, he was very, very well known, but he graciously read this manuscript from this hippie out on a commune. And he wrote me back on a yellow sheet of paper, a one-page letter. And the letter said that he really liked the book and he hoped it would get published. And I kept that letter since I got that letter in 1970. And in 2016, I turned that letter into the University of Massachusetts. They have archived all my papers. And you can see that letter from Howard Zinn to me online at the University of Massachusetts archive. It is so cool. It blows my mind. And you can see it in exact, you know, the letter's kind of torn and it's on yellow paper and all this stuff. But it aged very well. I held on to it for, 45 years. And because of that letter, the editor-in-chief of the paperback division at Harper & Row, a guy named Hugh Van Dusen, who stayed there for 50 years, he just retired. I'll never forget this. You know, he was in his 30s or something, and I was 24. And he looked at me and says, you know...
Hold that thought. Hold that thought, Sluggo. We're gonna go to a break, and we will come back with Harvey Sluggo Wasserman, who I'm sure will hit a long line drive over the fence.
Connecting you with the best of the conscious minds in the world. Om Times Radio, IOM FM. Om Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. Om Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
More than 24 million Americans have an autoimmune disorder, and that number continues to grow. I'm Sharon Saylor, and I'm one of those 24 million. To put that number in perspective, cancer affects about 9 million and heart disease up to 22 million. That's why I've brought together top experts and those thriving regardless of their diagnosis to bring you the latest, most up-to-date information. Join me, Sharon Saylor, Friday night, 7 p.m. Eastern, for the Autoimmune Hour on Life Interrupted Radio to find out how to live your life uninterrupted.
Are you done with the daily barrage of negativity? Ready for some positivity? Creations Magazine has been inspiring the soul for over 30 years, delivering thought-provoking and solution-driven articles, essays, and poetry that inspire you to enjoy a vibrant life. Holistic health, personal and spiritual growth, relationships, the environment, and so much more. Read us online or order a subscription, creationsmagazine.com.
I'm Fidel Nshombo. I was born in a city called Bukavu in the Congo. We were a loving family, and then, boom, everything that I had disappeared in a single day. People think that when you are a refugee and they resettle to America, and all your problems are done. They don't understand that that's the beginning of everything. I was not born a refugee. I was made one.
It's time we welcome refugee families with open arms. Learn more at EmbraceRefugees.org, brought to you by the Ad Council.
Steve Behrman back on WikiPolitiki with Harvey Sluggo Wasserman. I'm really happy to know that Sluggo came from baseball and not from the Ernie Bushmiller comic strip. I'm really happy to hear that. Anyway, we were talking about your book, that you were in the right place at the right time with the support of Howard Zinn, who kind of passed the baton to you. So when the book came out, what happened then? And I want to know more about what your view was, you know, at that time.
Well, what I wanted to do is write a book. I still have the book, by the way, and people can still get it from me at solartopia.org, which is my website, or harveywasserman.com. I own it now. It came back to me. And I wrote the book, and then I actually kind of forgot that I wrote it. I went up to Canada. This was in the spring of 1972. You'll love the story. And I hitchhiked across Canada. It was a wonderful, wonderful summer. And then I took a boat from Vancouver to Seattle, which I highly recommend. You can still do that. And then I hitchhiked down to San Francisco. And this was in October. And I was wandering around in Berkeley, barefoot. And I walked into a bookstore. It was either Moe's or Cody's, the two big bookstores in Berkeley.
Yeah.
I sat down on the floor and I picked up Rolling Stone. And there was a huge review of my book. I couldn't believe it. Somebody really took a liking. They ran a cartoon. It's the kind of review every author would kill for. Totally positive. And the book, the Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States, wound up selling 30,000 copies. Now, it got the title. My original title was A People's History of the United States, 1860 to 1920. And the sales manager at Harper said, no, it's too boring, you know. It's like a communist thing. It'll put people to sleep. And then one day he sticks his head in the door, and he says, Harvey Wasserman's History of the United States. And I said, Irv, you know, that's embarrassing. You can't do that. And he said, he looks me dead in the eye. He says, Harvey Wasserman, that's the kind of name all you hippies really like. I said, okay, if Howard likes it, then we'll go with it. And Howard liked it, and then, of course, he got together with you, the chief editor at Harper Paperbacks, and they did A People's History of the United States. And that sold, continues to sell, 2 million copies. So my newest book, The Life and Death Spiral of U.S. History, is kind of a 60s hippie take on Howard Zinn's People's History of the United States. Because, you know, he was the great mentor, and he had the great politics, and we were together on the idea that history really is made by the common people. I mean, you could talk about the famous ones, the Washingtons and Lincolns and Roosevelts and Kennedys, but it's really the people as a whole who matter. And so my new book is a history of the whole United States, from the Indians all the way through Trump. But it, it's very, very radical, as you might guess, and it's totally cultural. I mean, one thing that we miss, and, you know, in the 60s and during the Vietnam War, we're facing two major upheavals. We had a cultural upheaval, drugs, sex, and rock and roll, and we had the end of empire and the imposition of corporate rule on the United States. And we had two revolutions going, and we won the Cultural Revolution, but, you know, we haven't quite won the the class revolution. Let's put it that way. I mean, the culture today, and it's easy to lose track of, but the culture of the United States and of the world today has been completely transformed by what happened in the 1960s. You know, it's hard to discern, but if you look back at what people looked like before the Beatles, you know, it was a different planet, for God's sake. And things that we take for granted now were just completely out of the realm of any kind of possibility back then. Unfortunately, you know, we haven't done so well in terms of class consciousness or class revolution or saving the environment. But attitudes, I mean, you know, you could not, it was illegal to be gay in the United, literally illegal. You could be arrested for being gay in the United States until 2003, for God's sakes. The idea of gay marriage was just completely, are you kidding? You know, nobody talked about that. Nobody was even, I mean, very, very rare was anybody openly gay until Stonewall in 1969. So this has been a really radical transformation in terms of music, art, feminism, cultural sensibilities, and we can take great pride in that. Unfortunately, we haven't done too well on the empire side.
Well, how do you figure that? I mean, right now, of course, the big issue with this new Supreme Court justice nominee and so on is that he's going to go backward on the cultural issues. Do you think that that's something that's going to be Trumpism is going to be able to reverse, or do you think that they're, in that regard, they're a blip on the radar?
No, it's irreversible. You know, it's gone. The horse is out of the barn. They can lock the barn up all they want, but that race has been won. You know, and I want to say something right now, by the way, that's very, you know, these people claim to be anti-abortion. And, you know, they want to make abortion illegal as if that's going to stop abortions. What really stops abortions is sex education and birth control. And I will have to say, and I'm going to, you know, that the average liberal or leftist in this country is way more effective at stopping abortions or preventing abortions than the so-called pro-life movement. I mean, if you want to prevent abortions, have sex education and pass out condoms. That's the way it happens. And you know, and Colorado, for example, which had a very aggressive condom and sex education programs, dropped the number of abortions 40% very quickly. Same with teen pregnancies. I mean, I don't understand a movement that claims to be anti-abortion and then simultaneously fights against sex education and birth control and child welfare. I mean, none of that makes any sense to me. So,
well, you know, that
the Supreme Court.
What? You're flipping out there. The sense that it doesn't make. It's that these people really aren't interested in abortion. They're really interested in perpetuating the values of the patriarchy. So I think that the abortion, that's really their simple excuse. But if you look at all of these things, and that's why I think that there should be no surprise that I call them Christianists because they wouldn't know Jesus if he walked up to them. But those people are really much more interested in the father's authority and so on. That's why they're so susceptible to Trump. So it shouldn't be that mysterious.
Well, you got to see Trump as the last gasp of the frustrated white male, and you're right, Christianist. I mean, if Jesus, I'm a big fan of Jesus. You know, we Jews, we call him Yeshua. He was a nice Jewish radical boy. He was probably the only unmarried Jewish guy in Jerusalem at his age. You know, his mother, you can see, you know, his mother came. Mary came to Jerusalem when they were stringing him up. And, you know, come on, get married already. So, you know, and the Sermon on the, I wonder how many of these Christianists have read the Sermon on the Mount. I mean, come on, it's a great piece of work, you know. And we think, we Jews think that it really came from Rabbi Hillel, you know, who was that famous, who was a contemporary of Jesus, and who was asked very famously, if you can, to describe the essence of the Torah while standing on one foot. And he said, love thy neighbor as thyself. And, you know, does Trump love his neighbor as thyself? Come on. So I actually, in my new book, I talk about the Puritans in Boston. If Jesus had started preaching on a street corner in Boston in the 1630s, they'd have strung him up. I mean, he wouldn't have lived very long. So, yeah, you know, you're right about it. Trump is really the last gasp of the white male patriarch. And, you know, again, the horse is out of the barn. Women have been a voting majority in this country since 1920. They are two-thirds of the college students now. And they are also a majority in the law schools. And, you know, when a majority of the lawyers become women, it's over. That includes my wife, by the way. So, you know, Trump is, again, a desperate attempt to embodies a desperate attempt of the old misogynist patriarch. I had a great interview. Actually, it's in a film. There was an Iroquois woman, a Haudenosaunee woman, an older woman, and they asked her, why was it that if the women ran the tribes, why were the men the chiefs? And she said, she said, well, it makes them feel important, and it gives them something to do.
Yeah, so if only we had adopted that, you know, if only we adopted the Council of Grandmothers.
Well, it's happening. It's happening. We will have a matriarchy in this country, but the woman who becomes the first president is going to have to be way more powerful and committed to something other than herself than Hillary Clinton. I mean, she was a disaster as a candidate. She would have been a terrible president. And she, you know, like Al Gore and John Kerry, she won the election and didn't fight for it. And
exactly.
I read her book. You referred at the top of the hour to my article, 57 Ways of the Corporate Democrats Have Enthroned Trump Putin. I mean, you know, Al Gore won the election of 2000, and then he lost it at the Supreme Court, and he did nothing. I mean, we know the voter rolls were stripped by Jeb Bush in Florida in 2000. We know the electronic voting machines were flipped, and we know that the Electoral College took the presidency away. And, I mean, you know, we're happy that Al Gore went out and has done all this stuff on global warming, but, you know, what good does it do? So,
well, yeah.
You know, and the same with John Kerry. We know that John Kerry won the election in Ohio in 2004, and we showed him. Now, I was living in Columbus at the time. We showed him, my co-writer, Bob Fetrakis, who's a lawyer and an election protection expert and a professor. We showed Kerry's people 30 ways from Sunday how that election was stolen. He has yet to say the first word about it. And I read Hillary Clinton's book after the election of 2016 called What Happened. It was excruciating. I mean, she was so arrogant. And, you know, she puts down Jill Stein. Jill's Green Party, after the election of 2016, went in and showed how it was stolen in Michigan and Wisconsin. And, you know, her people, Hillary's people, did nothing. That election was stolen 40 ways from Sunday. And so what's going to happen in 2018? The same stuff. They're stripping the voter rolls. They're going to flip the voting machines. And, you know, he'll retain control of Congress unless they do something. And it's not – you can't blame – you know, they're still blaming Ralph Nader for the election of 2000. It was Al Gore who threw it in the towel on the election of 2000. I mean, it's ridiculous. And now we have – the problem we have with Trump politically is, okay, you know, I get 6-10 emails a day for this candidate and that candidate, and all talking about how terrible Trump is. But they're not offering an alternative. And that's what I tried to do with my book, Solartopia. You know, we now have the technology to go 100% to renewable energy. We know about social justice. We have more than enough resources to provide housing, food, medical care, and education for every American, really everybody in the world. And what do we got? The Democrats aren't doing anything. Only Bernie Sanders is talking about that. And they screwed him in 2016, and they still can't deal with serious progressive leftists. So it's a tragedy.
Well, the party certainly, I mean, I think of a turning point. I loved Oliver Stone's series on the untold history of the United States, and that turning point in 1944, where the bad guys pushed in Harry Truman to replace Henry Wallace as vice president. And, you know, that's before both of us were born, but we've been dealing with the repercussions of the Cold War mentality, drummed up fear. Probably you and I both had the experience of shelter drills, hiding under the desk. If in case of nuclear attack, put your head between your knees and kiss your ass goodbye, that sort of stuff. And it seems like we've been on this trajectory for 70 to 75 years, if not longer, if you go back to 1860 and so on. So
we're going to talk. You're absolutely right about that. I watched Oliver Stone's series. It was terrific. And I can say without any hesitation that Henry Wallace, had he been president or had he been vice president when Franklin Roosevelt died and become president, he would never have dropped the atomic bombs on Japan. Never would have done it. And I'll also say, pretty much as every bit as certain, if John Kennedy had lived, we would not have had the Vietnam War. John Kennedy, by the time he was murdered, had pretty clearly decided to pull out of Vietnam. And, you know, a case can be made that that's one of the many reasons he was assassinated. I do not for one minute believe that Lee Oswald killed him. I don't even think that Lee Oswald fired a shot that day. But the bottom line is that the decision, the most crucial decisions that have shaped our current world and made it the mess that it is A, when Henry Wallace was pulled off the ticket in 44, because he would have been a very, very different president from Harry Truman, and B, when Kennedy was shot and then Lyndon Johnson escalated the war in Vietnam in March of 65. We have never really recovered from those two situations. And there was one other that nobody talks about, in the 1910s, Woodrow Wilson, who is, by the way, my least favorite of all American presidents, he is number one on my bottom feeder list, which is ironic because I had a Woodrow Wilson fellowship in graduate school, but he is the one who got us into World War I based on a lie, and then used that as a cover to crush the Socialist Party. I mean, we had a viable Socialist Party with a great leader, Eugene V. Debs, and in 1918, Woodrow Wilson essentially made the country into a fascist repressive regime where he used the federal apparatus to crush the Socialist Party, crush the IWW, the Radical Labor Movement, put Eugene V. Debs and many, many others in prison for no reason whatsoever. And that was really one of the very worst and most formative imperial moments in all of U.S. history. So since you asked at the top, how do we get where we are, I would cite those three moments.
Sluggo, we are just about to go to a break right now. When we come back, we'll talk about Solartopia and where we can go from here. So we should be – there we go. We'll talk with you very soon.
Thank you.
Sluggo Wasserman, Solartopia, and this is Wiki Politicky. Thank you.
Free your mind with Om Times Radio, IOM FM.
Ascending Hearts is no ordinary dating site, but a spiritual dating site with a purpose, to link you with your soulmate. We engineer the serendipity so you can trust that you will attune with someone that has the same matching vibration as you. Ascending Hearts, the conscious dating site for the spiritually aware. Try Ascending Hearts for free, ascendinghearts.com.
Hello, I'm Lisa Berry. Join me every Monday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time for Light on Living, a chance to see new, hear different, and feel more as I shine the spotlight on all the ways to lighten the load of life's challenges. Light on Living is your link to that new way you're looking for, that new understanding that will enhance your life, and that positive connection that will support your growth. So join me, and you'll gain insight and start to see things in a new way that motivates you.
The Shift Network, presenting transformative programs and events to help you awaken to your full potential so that together we can build the more beautiful world our hearts know is possible. Our classes support you in finding and cultivating your gifts and in bringing those gifts to the world to create tangible change and connect us as global citizens. Go to theshiftnetwork.com or follow the link on the Wiki Politiki sponsors page.
My name is Meera Batra, and this is How I Live United. Many families have come to America for a better life. I advocate for these families with United Way. United Way empowers them to see opportunities available. We help them get involved with their kids, schools, and network within the community. My name is Meera Batra. I help families see opportunity and succeed. I don't just wear the shirt. I live it.
Give, advocate, volunteer, live united. Go to liveunited.org. Brought to you by United Way and the Ad Council.
Okay, Steve Behrman back with Wiki Politiki and Harvey Sluggo Wasserman. We're talking about history, and you know, it kind of reminds me of Swami's statement, which is, those who fail to learn the lessons of history condemn the rest of us to repeat it. And I think that, you know, what we had in this past election, and see if you agree, is that we had this these alternative alt history memes, which I think what has been called the deep state, et cetera, and the mainstream corporatists, neocons and neolibs, were very, very susceptible to the fake news notion because, unlike the right wing press, which outright lies, the progressives like lying to themselves. They prefer to not get all the news that's fit to print from the New York Times. They prefer having their news managed and crafted, as opposed to the outright lies that the right wing seems to tell. What's your take on how that news impacted this election? And then, finally, which we want to get to, Solartopia and how what we can do now, what Caroline Casey calls the sane and reverent among us, what can we do to shift the situation?
Well, what you got to remember, Steve, is that Hillary actually won the election by 3 million votes. I mean, she won by 30 times the margin that John Kennedy won by. And more than Nixon won in 68. I mean, it's, you know, and then she just walked away. In her book, she talks about how she started to sip Chardonnay and walk her dogs. I mean, come on, you know. You turn the country over to, and you're doing nothing. And she has done nothing. But she won by 3 million votes, at least. And another million that they stripped off the voter rolls. So we have a Democratic Party now led by Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, I mean, need I say more? And Andrew Cuomo in New York, for God's sake. I mean, I wish Cynthia Nixon, who's running a very good candidate, running against Andrew Cuomo in New York, I wish she had a last name, a different last name. It's hard for me to support anybody named Nixon. You know, she's terrific. And so what we're looking at here, not only is Trump the last gasp culturally of the white Christianist, you know, male chauvinist, misogynist, but he's also the last gasp of the oil and gas industry. And this is a very big deal. And this is one of the dimensions of his connection to Putin, because Putin needs, in Russia, their primary income is oil and gas. And whenever the gas prices go down, they get into financial trouble. And one of the primary missions of Trump's presidency has been to raise oil prices. I mean, they've doubled oil prices since he took power. Nobody's talking about it. And, of course, he loves nuclear power, too. It's all part of the same corporatist power. So not only culturally is it a shift from the male domination to a matriarch, but in terms of our energy, which is really the most important facet of our industrial economy, we are shifting incredibly quickly from fossil and nuclear fuels, or what I call King Kong, coal, oil, nukes, and gas, to wind and solar. And that's what Solartopia is about. And I got to say, since I was part of the birth by happenstance of the anti-nuclear movement in this country, and we coined the term no nukes. And when we were asked, well, if you stop nuclear power, and we did stop the nuclear plant that was trying to be built in our town, if you stop nuclear power, where are you going to get the energy? And we just kind of said, well, we didn't know what we were talking about. We said, okay, well, how about wind and solar? And, you know, they say, oh, it's not practical. But if you look back since the 1970s, the wind and solar industry has been one of the most phenomenal economic and technological success stories in human history. I mean, the price of solar and wind has continued to plummet. It's quite astounding, actually. And weak as Hillary was, you know, under her, I'm sure we would have had a much more rapid transition to solar. And that's what these guys are afraid of, because the our energy supply can be controlled by communities and by individual building owners and outside the Russians who make all the money in the world based on their control of energy. And that's what the
well, you know, we seem to be at a point right now where the two sides are living in two separate realities, and that if we go back to the Nixon pre-impeachment of Nixon, there was a kind of a bipartisan consensus about honesty and the rules of engagement, and there was the Nixon impeachment movement was not a partisan movement. At this point, one of the complicating factors, regardless of what gets revealed about, I think you're definitely on the right track with Trump Putin and Trump being a Russian asset, if not controlled by the capo, Putin. We have two separate realities, and the people who follow Trump actually are. We'll probably call that fake news when it comes out. How is that? How do we deal with that? Oh, do we lose our man? Harvey has, and
Hi,
has,
Steve.
Oh, good. Okay, he's on now. Good. You didn't miss anything. I was talking. Okay. What I was asking is that given where we are right now. What can most people what's the way forward for what Caroline Casey calls the sane and reverent among us?
Well, you got to resist. I mean, Maxine Waters, I've met her a few times, boy. She's tough as nails. And you know, we cannot give in. The difference between the United States today and Germany in the 1930s is that we are resisting. And people are not, you know, rolling over for this guy. That's what's crucial. And the same with solar. I live in Los Angeles now, and I'm in the business of installing solar. Anybody listening to the show, you want solar on your house, contact me. I'm at solartopia@gmail.com. And we have the technology. I'm working with my neighbor from down the street, And, you know, we are going to do this house by house and building by building and vacant lot by vacant lot. And the technology is there. But the bottom line is to, you know, we have to see this as this Trump phenomenon as a passing, well, we have to make sure it's a passing phase. You know, a lot of people in Germany viewed Hitler as a passing phase, but then they didn't go out and fight. The only way Trump is a passing phase is if we make him a passing phase. And so, you know, whatever your issue is, do not cave in. And number one is to make sure we have fair elections. I mean, we can win this back by election. The other great thing about the difference between America and Germany is that we have the public on our side. Trump is not loved. In fact, he's despised. And people aren't stupid. They know where he's coming from and who he is, and that the next guy who will be less, you know, less of a gangster or appear to be less of a gangster is still going to be very reactionary. And we also have to rely on the fact that nature bats last and that our Mother Earth is not going to take everything that's being done to her lying down. And so we have to continue to do what we do, to march, to organize, to see that we get fair elections, which is really crucial. I mean, you have to remember that three of the five elections, well, the last five presidential elections, were stolen. Al Gore was the rightful winner in 2000. John Kerry was the rightful winner in 2004. And Hillary Clinton was the rightful winner in 2016. And to their everlasting discredit, none of them have come forward to fight for what the public voted for. So we have to make sure that that doesn't continue to happen. I mean, Barack Obama... Yeah.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I mean, under Barack Obama, in the 8 years of his presidency, the Democratic Party lost 1,000 elections, state, local, and federal. And he didn't say a word. He just, you know, cruised along as if everything was okay. It's not okay. We do have a tradition in this country of election, for better or worse. I mean, at one point, up to 1860, slaves were counted for 3/5 of a vote. And that's gone, thankfully. And people without property couldn't vote. And women couldn't vote. Indians couldn't vote. Indigenous people only became citizens of the United States in 1924, for God's sakes. So, you know, I talk about that in my history book, my new one. So, you know, we have the population of this country is on our side. What's happened is that our government has been taken over totally by moneyed corporations. You know, we now have a system of $1, one vote. And that's what's killing us. And so it's not going to be easy, but it will be fun. And it's going to be tough.
And I appreciate that perspective. And by the way, if you go to my WikiPolitiki page under this interview, which will be recorded and accessible, you'll see a link to the article, 57 Unpatriotic Ways the Corporate Democrats Have Enthroned Trump Putin. And I, having read that, that's what actually inspired me to give you a call about doing an interview, because it's really very, very important that we recognize that the Democratic Party, I mean, my joke is that we have two parties, the Democratic Party and the Undemocratic Party. But the Democratic Party has not truly represented us. They're kind of like in the Peanuts comic strip, they're like Lucy pulling away the football. Every year, every 2 years, they pull away the football. They don't stand up to us. One of my other guests on this show, Mark Crispin Miller, wrote the book Fooled Again about the stolen elections. He, too, approached John Kerry and got a blank stare. He was shocked, by the way, Mark was, that the so-called progressive press, the left-wing press, Mother Jones, Democracy Now!, these institutions did not pick up on the stolen election. It was kind of like a third rail that they were afraid to touch, kind of like the Kennedy assassination, the Martin Luther King assassination, and all of these other perpetrations that I think have created post-traumatic stress disorder in the body politic, which is why we've been acting so weird.
Well, what we really have on the left, or you know, the non-Republican, the non-Trump in this country, we have corporate Democrats and we have social Democrats. And, you know, Bernie is a social Democrat. He's not really a socialist. I mean, the socialists in this country advocated for public ownership of all the major means of production, and Bernie doesn't ask for that. He's a social Democrat. He's a New Dealer, and that's what we need, at least for the time being, to push ahead. And so the difference is this, between the corporate Democrats and the social Democrats. My History of the U.S. is going to be ready pretty soon, Stephen. I hope you'll call me when it comes out. I'll send you a copy, and we can talk about the cycles of history and have a lot of fun with that.
Good. Well, I look forward to our next conversation. and this one's just about done.
What's that?
Oh, looks like we're on. We're done. Okay. Harvey Sluggo Wasserman, he's got a new book coming out on the updated history of the U.S. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and we look forward to the next time. Steve Behrman, Wiki Politiki. We'll be with
Steve.
You next week. Thank you, Harv. You are too. Bye.
Bye-bye.